so much older then. I'm younger than that now.
Welcome back to Growing Bolder, where we celebrate the opportunities ahead through the stories of men and women who are living big, bold lives. But of course, we can't take advantage of those opportunities without also dealing with the many challenges of life, especially as we age. And one of those challenges that very few like to talk about or really even acknowledge is the fear of cognitive decline, Alzheimer's and related dementias. There is still such a stigma around dementia that we ignore symptoms in ourselves and in our loved ones. We avoid conversations about brain changes. We want to believe that it is just normal aging. We want to hope for the best because we are terrified of the worst. Tipa Snow is one of the world's leading advocates and educators for anyone that is living with dementia or other forms of brain changes. 40 years of clinical and academic experience informs the work that she now does around the world to provide awareness, knowledge, and hands-on skills in dementia care. We spoke with Tipa about what steps we can all take to protect our brain health and why it's important to not let the stigma of dementia get in the way of taking action today. Give us, if you will, Tipa, kind of like a state of the union, because you're a pioneer. You've been doing this for more than 40 years. The age wave that we all knew was coming is now upon us. And I'm guessing that there's probably people that are better experts about what's happening in terms of research and maybe better experts in terms of prevention, but there's nobody better at dealing with caring for someone that has dementia. Well, are we where you'd like us to be?
Oh, we're so far behind the curve. It's frightening. We are on an hourly, minute-by-minute basis gaining more people in the population of those who have the preclinical symptoms but are starting to show some patterns of behavior and then are actually entering into life is changing and will need some support. And we are still trying to think that that's just typical aging. That can't be what it is. So I don't think we need to worry about it yet. I don't think there's anything we need to do in advance. I don't see any reason to change anything at this moment. And it's like, well, now would be the time. Because if I said to you, you could possibly buy yourself 5 to 8 years of not having clinical symptoms that are pretty significant to changing your life and my life as your support, what would you say back to me?
Tell me how.
Yeah. Well, you would think that. But when it comes to dementia, everybody's so scared of it. Well, no, that's just normal aging, right? So if I just do my New York Times crossword puzzle and I go out and do a little bit of walking and I try not to drink too much and I try to be a little social, that'll do it, right? And it's like, well, for a lot of us, it won't. It's not, because it's already changing. So I think the reality is we're going to be swept away unless we start recognizing there is dementia in the world. And I might be the one who's starting to show symptoms. So what could we do together that would make this transition less problematic? Because if I'm the one developing the condition, you might be the person who's providing care. And without the right knowledge and skill, your stress level starts to go up. And one of the really strong indicators of a risk pattern for spontaneous dementia, not the genetically pre-programmed type, is distress over periods of your time, life. So if I can get you less distress because you're going, okay, so it looks like we've got something cooking. So when you say, listen, I don't want people messing with stuff. Oh, you're not wanting people to move stuff. Okay, well, you've got a couple of piles here. Tell me about those piles. Is real different than, Dad, what are you doing? This stuff is all over the place. You can't know where anything is. You can't even find anything. You haven't even done taxes last year. What do you hear in my voice?
Stress. Yes. Frustration.
Yeah, and I'm a generation younger, but I'm coming. And so I'm at high risk now if this pattern doesn't shift, and we've done it for so many generations. It's like, we know better. How can we start to do better? And that's, oh, we're so delayed. There's so much fear and there's so much hope for this magic thing, the pill, the infusion, the whatever, that will take it all away. And I was just in San Diego at the Salk Institute for an international conference on researchers who are saying, eh, this is going to be like cancer. It's going to be bits and pieces and maybe here but not there. What's the most common type of dementia for people over the age of 80, do you think?
Alzheimer's?
See, you would think that. Actually, it's not. The most common is called late. It's a different kind of protein malformation that only mostly happens to old adults. And it has a profound effect in about a fourth of people, and about a third of everybody over 85 has it. And it's only been discovered. It's called TDP-43. It's only been discovered in the last 5 years. I mean, there's incredible research. But that doesn't mean the care is keeping up, because if we find out this, then we need to start coming up with care plans, and we don't even know it exists for the vast majority of people. Even in the know, it's still a new idea that we have a different thing. It's not Alzheimer's. It's something different. Mm. And it's like, it has a different pattern. It has a profound pattern, and it's going to affect a large number of people over 85.
I read something actually just this morning that said that the extent of non-diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment is 90%, which might mean that as many as 7.5 million Americans have mild cognitive impairment and don't know about it, which means we're not doing anything about it.
I would actually say it's a little higher than that. We know that about 80% of people with mild dementia have not yet been diagnosed. 80% have progressed past MCI, and we still haven't diagnosed in 80% of cases. It's not until mid-state dementia that we're going, oh, I think we have dementia. But of course, at that point, people think we're in early. It's like, oh no, we skipped that. And we could have done a lot of things in those early state, MCI particularly. But we just keep thinking, well, that's just normal aging, right? And it's like, no, this is not normal aging. If you don't have a baseline, you don't know what's normal for you. And the problem is we still don't have people taking baselines on cognitive, even simple baselines, not even as dramatic as the latest stuff coming out on the MoCA, which I'm sure everybody's heard all about, the Montreal cognitive test that Trump and Biden and all those folks, and they even did on CBS News kind of thing. But even simpler than that, like name as many animals as you can in a minute, verbal fluency, and let's see how many of those you get. And then in 6 months, let's see what it looks like, because we should maybe see a little slowing, but we shouldn't see a change in how you do that. Maybe draw a clock. Shouldn't see a big shift in how you do the numbers and then how you put the time on it. Those are two real quick, one minute, and we sort of have some data that the next time you come in, we take a look again.
I wouldn't ask you to diagnose leading political leaders, but since you mentioned their names, I think what we're all seeing in real time, at least people forgetting names, when you see that, what should we take from that?
Well, I mean, I think we have baselines we can look back on previous conversations, how they presented previously. And I think that certainly raises the question of, is this normal aging that we're seeing? Or is this somebody in a pressure cooker who's feeling a lot of distress and stress and really not getting enough sleep and really not taking care of themselves very well? Or is this somebody who's like cooking with gas? And if we don't shift what's going on for folks, yeah, it could be situational, but it could also be more than situational. And I think that's the challenge we face with no baselines and no monitoring. Is this something that if I get you in a situation that's less stressful and I put you in this situation and you start eating well and you start exercising well and socializing more, can we turn this stuff around a bit and buy time? And the answer is, yeah, we can. We have data on this, but not if we ignore it and just keep going the way we're going.
And that really is kind of the big development in the last few years, as we've all said for a long time, lifestyle choices we make can delay, maybe prevent, slow down the progression of. But now there's actual research that proves it. I mean, that's changed the narrative coming out of a lot of these national Alzheimer's dementia organizations.
You would think. But we still don't want to look and say, but so I have some mild cognitive impairment. Should I do something about it other than, is there a pill I can take?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, not the evidence there is not strong. What's strong is let's go back to your lifestyle. And for the kids that are helping you, let's look at their lifestyle while we're at it. Because the sooner we start that lifestyle pattern, it has to be a pattern. It can't be something you do on Mondays. That's where we see the biggest bang for the buck. We know that getting out in nature, spending time with animals, being social, all of those can have impact. Eating well, look at how when we eat. I mean, it does matter. I'm sorry, but it does matter. So there's no free ride. And I know people are thinking, but George Burns, and it's like, oh yeah, I mean, there's always super agers. There's really lucky people and really genetically gifted people. Are you one of them? Well, maybe so, but maybe not. I'd rather stack the odds in my favor in case I'm not one of them.
All of that said, what I love about you and what you do is that you're so aligned with what Growing Bolder attempts to do. I mean, we're trying to destigmatize aging as a whole, not by ignoring the reality of the struggle, by understanding what's there, but helping people understand they still have the ability to extract joy out of the moment. As I understand, that's what you do. I mean, you're helping people live their best life for as long as they can, given the circumstances. I would describe for me what positive approach to care is all about.
So if you can't figure out why we're here and you say, listen, I need to get to work. And I'm like, well, you've been retired a long time. We're not doing that anymore. That's called reality orientation. And all it's likely to do is frustrate you and frustrate me. So I don't see the value in doing it. I acknowledge, wow, okay, got to get to work. So you got to get to work. So tell me more. Now, do you need to go for an interview or something different? And now all of a sudden, rather than a disagreement, we're having a discussion. And if I know a little about you, which I obviously did, or we wouldn't know what kind of work you did, I could say, is it a meeting or something else? That's called a this or a that option. How many words did you have to come up with on your own? You said you wanted to go to work. And I said, for an interview or something else?
Interview.
Now, what I did is I had to pause and I had to wait to see if you did get the message. Took you a few beats. You came back. You were on target with it. What are you doing right now?
Having a conversation.
Yeah, you get to do your work right here because I figured out what you were feeling the need to do. You needed to feel productive and valued, and you needed to have something to do with this time that was empty for you. And I just gave you me. Because I'm going to be involved with you one way or the other. Either you're trying to get to work and I'm saying, Dad, no, you don't. And in that moment, what's really hard for families is to recognize Dad doesn't realize I'm the daughter. And I have to be willing to let go of my role of daughter to be his support care in this moment. Because he didn't say, hey, sweetheart, can you get me to work or something? He was like, I'm not sure who you are, but I'm asking you. So that's an example of how we take the moment that comes up and decide to put value into it rather than to create conflict in it.
I saw my father ask my mother what's for lunch 8 times in 15 minutes, and she got very frustrated, made him feel like He was an idiot.
Yeah.
How do you answer that question?
So you're wanting to know what we're having for lunch.
I do.
Yeah. Now, were you thinking something hot or cold?
I would like a sandwich.
You want a sandwich. Well, you know what? Sounds like a great idea. Come with me and look at what we've got in the refrigerator, because I would prefer making something you like. So come with me. Now, what just happened?
You've sucked me into something where I'm busy and I'm engaged.
So what was happening for you while I was fixing lunch? Or even before that? What was happening to that time for your dad?
Nothing.
Nothing. So what could he do to interact with his spouse? what are we having for lunch? Because he didn't know how to fill that void. And because she didn't have the skill to do something different, it became confrontational. Because she was trying to do something and he just kept asking the same question over and over and over. It's like, yeah, he will, because he's trying to connect. And he doesn't know what else to do. And he feels sort of useless.
Simple, maybe too trite to say, but we can't bring them back, so we have to go with them.
Yeah, I mean, so we go with their flow. So that I call it going with the flow, because I can't, sort of like water in a stream. I mean, if it's heading downhill, you know, trying to swing it around and bring it back uphill, but I can divert a little bit and sort of see if I can get it not to like wash out a riverbank. But it's not my job to reverse the flow of the river. It's my job to help the river flow as gently as we can and maybe hit some still water and sort of create those little eddies that aren't like falling waterfalls or crashing sort of awful stuff that people feel like they're going to wreck on the rocks. Smooth it out a little bit.
Smooth out the impact of the disease. And while some are trying to cure it and some are trying to prevent it, Tipa Snow's pioneering work is helping those who actually have it and those who are caring for those who have it learn how to live with it in a way that preserves dignity and maintains a quality of life. When we return, Tipa on the importance of all older adults getting a baseline cognitive test, plus the host of one of daytime television's highest-rated talk shows, and also how are women in prison helping themselves while helping veterans with PTSD. This is Growing Bolder. We've got news. Watch.growingbolder.com, the world's first streaming site for active adults, is now live. Growing Bolder TV shows, national specials, documentaries, and inspiring videos on ordinary people living extraordinary lives 24/7 on demand for free. Watch.growingbolder.com is now live. Welcome back to Growing Bolder as we continue our conversation with pioneering dementia care expert Tipa Snow. Tipa has worked for decades to destigmatize a diagnosis of dementia so that we'll lose our fear of talking about it and testing for it. Now you read about the fact there's blood tests, there's AI that's figuring this stuff out, but what do you say to somebody? Because, you know, you read all the time, well, that's just the normal side of aging. If we start to not be able to get the word, if we can't complete the thought, at what point do we get tested? What do we do?
Well, see, this is where if we had a baseline, then we could say, you know, you are seeing some shifts. Tell me how you're feeling about that first. How are you doing with that? Okay, I feel like crap. And tell me what you're doing every day, because now I know where there's potential for shift. So you're having trouble with some words. Tell me what you're doing on a daily pattern. What's your sleep pattern? What's your social pattern? How often are you playing games with yourself about, okay, let's name as many animals as you can. Okay, timer, chick. And let's play with that. Now I'm going to give you visuals of animals and ask you to do it, to see what happens when we add a visual imagery part. So we quit seeing it as dead ends and we start seeing it as avenues of possibility, because we don't know. We truly are just on that front edge of what happens if we do intervene in those times. What happens if we do take that chance of like, okay, so you're having some language things. Are they mostly nouns or verbs? I mean, really getting curious about it instead of being so scared. You know, I can't think of words. And it's like, okay, what kind? Have you ever done a foreign language? You know, those kinds of questions. How about if we play with this stuff instead of get so worried about it? Turns out the chemistry of your brain just changes just like that. And guess what you can suddenly do that you couldn't do 5 minutes ago? Find those words. Because we are incredibly facile at neuroplasticity, truly. And once we recognize things are changing, instead of getting all gloom and doom on it, say, well, okay, well, let's see what we could do if we play around with it a little bit. Try dancing with a part and doing a new kind of dance step. Try Tai Chi and then exercise and then use your brain. See what happens.
You are, you know, definitely a glass half full kind of a gal, but go to the dark side for a minute, if you will, because when you look at the 10,000 of us that are, have been turning 65 every day for the last 20 years, 15
and
years.
Nobody noticed.
and nobody noticed. But the burden of care, both on families and agencies and the government, I mean, how bad might it be?
It's getting to where it's going to be horrendous. We're going to lose families. We're going to lose people. We're going to lose care. I mean, we already are. Small nursing homes that were doing the community work are closing down. They can't stay funded. There's no funding for them. Families are crushing. They're crushed. They're crashing. There's not the resources they need. And this next up generation doesn't have any of the extras that the previous generation stored and used. They used that all up in the care. We don't have models that are working. And it's about to come crashing down on us. And the idea that we can afford 38,000 per person per year for an infusion that might change your score on a clinical test doesn't demonstrate any change in day-to-day function and not pay for anything for care, routine care, just seems crazy. I don't know another word to use. It just seems crazy that we are not in a better place than we are.
And there is this widening care gap, if you will, more older people and fewer younger people. And I know families, the divorce rate is high for baby boomers and families are moving. I mean, it's a situation where even if you're willing to care for somebody, it's difficult. But there's so many people that have nobody to care for them.
Yeah. I mean, a number of empty slots in a care rotation, whether it's at home or in a facility. I mean, we just don't have the personnel. We are not training new personnel. The number of gerontologists is going down, not up. The number of nurses and providers who want to get into geriatric care, but that's where we are. And so it's pretty scary, and we still don't have any requirement to understand dementia. No quiz you have to take, no skill you have to have. And that's where I think we are totally missing, where we could make the biggest difference in a very small cost ratio, is to bring people up to speed on some basic care skills so that it doesn't tear apart families and you could still manage to go to work, because we'd have five families working together and I'd take Monday off, you could take Tuesday, he could have Wednesday, and the five of the folks that we care for are hanging out together and we're doing some things together because we've learned some basic skill sets. I think we're going to have to form our own new family, if you would, to get us through this. Because spouses alone, kids alone, with one family, we've tried that model. And all we do is we got a next generation. We have the next one up.
We obviously have to have caregivers that have the type of skill set that you teach, and that is enabling people to not feel guilty or withdraw. But that said, I hear myself saying this, and sometimes I say, do you really believe this, Mark, that, you know, we're all trying to live in the moment, no matter who or where we are. And that is an ability that people with dementia have, is to live in the moment. And it's incumbent upon us to try to find a way to help them extract joy from that moment. Is that true?
It's all true. Yeah, because if they get joy and we get joy, we both have brain health. I mean, that phenomena of joy, of having moments where our brain feels good, actually creates the chemistry that keeps us going and sustains us through the harder parts.
Final question. Let's take dementia out of it altogether, your area of expertise, because you have lived a life. Just give us the deepest snow moral of the story, the takeaway about life in general. What do you feel about what makes a life worth living?
Yeah. For me, being of service makes my life worth living. If I can't serve in some fashion, that greater space, that greater situation. Why bother? I've got to find the service, even if that service is simply to be present and witness and hold space for someone. That, for me, is service. And for me, that's why I'm here, is to provide that which people can benefit from and I can find joy in.
Well, we're all grateful that you have that, the heart for doing it. Thank you. And thank you for your time.
Thank you.
There is so much important information to take from that interview, information that we really can't afford to ignore. Up to 90% of the people with mild cognitive impairment don't know that they have it. And if we did know, we could stave off any clinical symptoms for up to 8 years. Not wanting to know that we have cognitive impairment as early as possible is like not wanting to know that we have cancer as early as possible. You can watch our entire interview with Tipa and a lot more inspirational content on our free streaming platform at watch.growingbolder.com. Coming up, streaming is changing everything, including daytime TV, where The Ellen DeGeneres Show, Dr. Phil, and Rachel Ray have all gone away recently. So how has The Tamron Hall Show somehow avoided declining ratings just like almost every other daytime talker? What's the secret? We'll ask Tamron herself next on Growing Bolder.
Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts.
Welcome back to Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton. Our next guest is a two-time Emmy Award-winning, groundbreaking journalist, author, and now the host and executive producer of her own nationally syndicated talk show, now in its fifth season. Let's welcome Tamron Hall. Tamron, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, Mark. So good to speak with you.
You know, I can hear the smile in your voice. You know, one of the most appealing things about what you do, you obviously like to have fun, but you are a veteran journalist, and you like to lean into many of the meaty topics that we here at Growing Bolder like to talk about, social isolation, intergenerational connection, ageism. How do you balance the topics on your show?
You know, I really lead with the things that people are talking about in my social circle, right? I have, I think, a wide range of friends and family members. I'm from a small town in Texas, but I also happen to live in the big city of New York. And I feel that I have friends and people all in the middle, not to mention we listen to our TAM fam. That's what we call the amazing people who've kept us going for five seasons. And I think it's being a journalist for 30 years and also naturally being a curious person. I grew up, my nickname was not necessarily because I questioned everything. And that natural curiosity and also, I believe, the opportunity and the gift it is to listen to other folks, we come up with our topics. And you touched on the loneliness epidemic. I was actually at an event and someone said, yeah, you know, there's this new research about loneliness and how used to be, you know, that people thought of older people or the elderly, but we are in an epidemic of loneliness. And we called and reached out to the Surgeon General, who was phenomenal in this conversation that had people riveted of all ages. We're seeing staggering numbers when it comes to young people feeling isolated and alone, obviously made worse because of what we all experienced in 2020. But other issues like social media. And so it wasn't like a luxury conversation. It's the conversation that I tell people you have, you know, maybe if you're at breakfast and you had a couple of mimosas at brunch with friends and you're really being yourself. And when yourself, you are able to say, they gave me the quiz and it said that I was lonely. I don't feel alone. I'm surrounded by people all day long, whether it's work or professional, but we get in our own heads and sometimes we get in our own way. And so through my taking the quiz and this real conversation, we left inspired because there are things to do. There are groups where you can meet friends and There are ways to get out of your own way. So those are the kind of things we talk about on a more meaty, to your point, level. But we dig into, no pun intended, a good recipe, a good cooking show. Because like I said, I've been on this cooking journey for the past few years trying to improve it. And I'm sure my family's happy that I'm on that journey. But I love just talking to people. And that's what makes the show so well-rounded, that we can talk sports one day and then talk about the loneliness epidemic, or we have this huge week of love, and what does it mean to really be in love? That's how my brain works. I want to get into those kinds of things.
You know, it's a weird media landscape out there, as you know. There's more options than ever. And you mentioned the Tam fam. I mean, Taylor's got the Swifties, but my goodness, you've got the Tam fan. And that's critically important to having success these days, because those who are successful build community. And when you think about it, you know, the media business has seen an implosion, if you will, of a 60-year-old business model. Everything is changing. And just in the past year, the Ellen DeGeneres Show, Dr. Phil, Rachel Ray, they've all gone away. And among your competitors, you might be the only one who somehow has avoided declining ratings. Is it just the nature of who you are, or is this by design? Is this strategy? How are you doing this?
I think it's truly what I said. We're talking about the things that, you know, folks are talking about. I can go to lunch with you tomorrow and give you the rundown of the shows that we did over the past month. You would relate to, I think, 80% of that. How often do we see something or even hear something where that many people find themselves in the conversation? I was telling my nephew, who's 27, he's now gone to work for the Buffalo Bills. He used to work for the Dallas Cowboys. And I said, listen, I'm old enough to remember, as I put on my 53-year-old lady hat, when we all listened to a couple of radio stations. So I would listen, there's Elton John would come on, and Michael Jackson would come on, and Pat Benatar would come on, and Donna, and all of it was an experience. Even I'm an MTV era kid, and you turn it on MTV, and you see all of these different musicians from all over the world. I remember the first time I saw David Bowie on an MTV video. And so there were these collective experiences. I'm old enough again to remember the collective experience of a TV event. You know, Sunday night, it was a television event, and, you know, 30 million people would watch it. And now we, for the first time in human history, put ourselves in cages, so to speak, and lock ourselves in. Mm. And we isolate ourselves from the rest of the world, or we choose to surround ourselves with people who think like us, look like us, and exactly like us. And so we don't get exposed to this wide range of things. And with our show, because I'm a journalist for 30 years and I've been on probably 7 different shows at one time, it felt like I was able to pull in people who knew me from different things, whether it's Deadline Crime, the Today Show, MSNBC even. I used to host the show of Sister Wives, which is a hugely popular reality show. I had nothing in common with them. It was a Mormon family, plural marriage. And when I first started to, you know, do the after show, I thought, what am I getting into? I learned so much about their culture, their religion, and the life that they chose. It might not be a life for me, but it was a very curious experience for me. And so I think that's really what the show is. I say we laugh together, we cry together, we learn together. And I think that's what has allowed the show over these 5 seasons to continue to grow in the ratings, because if you listen to people, you never run out of things to talk about.
Amen. We are talking with the Tamron Hall, and you know, Tamron, you mentioned your age twice. I wouldn't do that without asking you first. But since you brought it up, you know, we've got at least 3 very divisive isms, if you will, in our culture: racism, sexism, and ageism. And you've had a good bit of experience confronting at least the first 2. And ageism is the one that's going to impact all of us if we're lucky enough to live long enough. Yeah. How have you been so successful maintaining your positivity, maintaining your career growth in the face of racism and sexism and now ageism?
You know, because I'm surrounded by people who inspire me. We just had a conversation with the award-winning and brilliant author, Hank Phillippe Ryan. Hank wrote her first crime thriller at age 57. She'd had a tremendously successful career as an investigative reporter in the Boston area. But at 57, she said, I walked into my husband and said, I'm going to write a crime novel. And now here she's one of the best to do it and sold millions and millions of copies of her different thrillers. So for me, I'm always inspired by people who look at the road and don't see the roadblocks, whether it's ageism, racism, sexism. Of course, there are substantive conversations that we should be having about these very real isms, to your point. But I also, and it is important for me to say, how can I see the road if I'm only looking at the roadblocks? Now, I know that that speed bump is there, but I'm going to get over it. I'm not going to let it stop me. And that's really the spirit of how I live. That's the spirit of the show. And those are some of the conversations that we have. We try to bring in people who inspire in different ways, and that you watching at home may feel like, oh, I don't have anything in common with that. I don't know. And then suddenly you're drawn in to what we are talking about. So we just explore these conversations. I'm not an anthropologist. I'm just a talk show host. I say to people, you're welcome to this table. Bring up whatever kind of chair that you have. I don't care if it's a card table or with a Barca lounger or a high chair. As long as you feel like you have a spot here, just pull it up.
You are far more than a talk show host. You are a voice of unity at a time when we need it so badly. Tamron Hall, consider me a member of the Tam Fan. Folks, she is Tamron Hall. She entertains, she educates, she inspires. She is a force of unity and acceptance in a culture that needs both more than ever. Tamron Hall airs weekdays, and for times and channels, all you have to do is go to TamronHallShow.com. Tamron, thanks so much.
Thank you.
As we get older, healthcare is more important than ever, but does it seem like it's harder than ever to get in to see your doctor? And when you finally do get an appointment, is it over in 20 minutes with your doctor sending you to a lab or a specialist? Well, that's because most medical practices are what's known as a fee-for-service model. Doctors are actually paid for every service they provide. So many see 30 patients a day and prescribe one medical visit, test, or procedure after another. But there's a new model of care that's called value-based care. Doctors are paid to keep you healthy, to not just treat disease, but to prevent it. AdventHealth Well 65 Plus is a value-based primary care provider, and we spoke with several of its physicians to learn what makes it different. Dr. Sashi Yoganand.
The moment you come in, to the moment you leave, to the moment you get home, we take care of you. And we look at you as an entire whole being. Mentally, physically, socially, and make sure all that fits in a certain line.
Whole person care for whatever stage of life you're in. There's never been a time in history with a wider range of life experiences and transitions for people 65 and older. AdventHealth Well 65 Plus focuses on the mental, physical, and spiritual health of their patients, even offering the services of licensed social workers available in the same office as the doctors to help with all of life's transitions. You could be an empty nester, perhaps your spouse has passed away, or you've retired and you're trying to decide what's next. Dr. Joyce Cortez.
There's more to medicine than just prescribing medications. It's about listening to the patients, providing other options, right? Including a healthier diet or exercise and having the support that they need.
Dr. Robert Rogers, Chief Medical Officer for AdventHealth Well 65 Plus.
It's the partnership that you're trying to form in our offices with your care team that kind of tries to look and identify what the ultimate health for you as a person is. And it may be different from the next patient that comes in. What do you want to do? What's going to be wholeness to you? And how can we get you there? And even though we have goals and we have metrics, it really comes down to how do we understand what the patient wants and how do we help them try to get there?
Of course, we all have different needs and desires when it comes to healthcare. There really is no one-size-fits-all. Well 65 Plus Primary Care is designed to treat individuals with whole person care, all within the same practice. In-house social workers, registered nurses, life coaches, a pharmacy team, and an on-site lab. They take their time to get to know you. They provide quick access to your doctor and your total care all under the same roof. More information at AdventHealthWell65Plus.com. Coming up, how service dogs are helping rehabilitate both women in prison and military veterans with PTSD. This is Growing Bolder. We've got news. Watch.growingbolder.com, the world's first streaming site for active adults, is now live. Growing Boulder TV shows, national specials, documentaries, and inspiring videos on ordinary people living extraordinary lives 24/7 on demand for free. Watch.growingbolder.com is now live. Welcome back to Growing Boulder. What do female inmates and military veterans with PTSD have in common? They are both receiving an unexpected opportunity at rehabilitation thanks to an innovative program from Patriot Service Dogs. We visited the Lowell Correctional Institute to learn more about the inmates who train the dogs and the veterans who receive them.
I did deployments to Afghanistan, to Kosovo, and when I did get out, I had issues. A lot of military do. In this day and age, honestly, we have more veterans committing suicide than we do dying in combat. And maybe I wasn't to that extreme yet, but my family regularly told me I was becoming more and more difficult to live with. And while I'm normally easy-natured, I was losing my temper a lot faster. I got very anxious when I was out in public, just dealing with things. I had a much shorter fuse than I used to. And I was going to the VA, like we all do, and I was doing therapy, and I was on different medications, and they all do serve their purpose. But my therapist mentioned that, you know, maybe I should consider getting a service dog. I sometimes think, you know, am I ever going to be back who I was before I joined the military and deployed? I don't think so, but Major, he actually helps bring you back to actually living an everyday normal life. He's changed my life. He's changed my family's life. He's been a huge impact.
But it never would have happened for Jim Williams if it wasn't for people determined to make a difference, like Julie Sanderson.
In 2009, I founded Patriot Service Dogs so that I knew that we were raising good dogs and that they were going to needy veterans at no cost.
The problem is it takes 2 years to train one dog. And where was she going to find trainers? Well, Julie took a surprising turn to the Lowell Correctional Institute, a state prison for women, and helped create a program where the dogs are trained by inmates.
I was very, very nervous when I started going into prison.
Push. Yes, good girl, good push.
Push. Yes, good push, good boy.
And just as these animals have a life-changing effect on people with PTSD, they do the same for many of the inmates who feel hopeless, lost, and unloved. Growing Boulder was granted permission to enter the prison, watch a training session, and talk to the inmates to find out just how important this program is for the women who take part.
I've been hurt a lot between my drug life and being incarcerated that I built up a wall. And the animals, I know they can't hurt me, and so I'm able to open up for them. And it just lets in a whole different, I can't even explain it. And I've actually just had this has just been coming to me now in the past month. I've realized that they brought so much emotion out of me that I haven't had in so many years. So it's something about the animals, I don't know.
This program has just given me back. I found myself again. I lost myself for a long time. I gave up who I used to be, and now I have found myself again. It's given me a sense of stability, purpose, drive, ambition. The dogs themselves don't judge you. When people come to us, and the veterans, or even you, when you come to see us, you don't look at us like inmates. You look at us like people, like we're actually doing something for the community. And that helps us to grow, and it's going to give us a purpose when we get out of here to continue to strive to be better every day. So I just love this program.
My father passed this month, the beginning of the month, and, you know, he said, you know, how proud he was of me, how much I've inspired him. And if I wasn't here in this program, I don't think I would have been able to make him proud. So it's not just about training dogs. It's really about working on yourself. You get to become this amazing person, and you just don't know when it's happened. You know, I can't pinpoint, you know, a date or a time. It's just
I'm able today to look in the mirror and know that I've overcame so many things. And it's an amazing feeling to actually love the person you are.
Get the keys. That's it.
And here's where the inmates and veterans have something in common. Each are very different than they were when they first went away. Each still have personal challenges to overcome, and each can struggle to fit into their communities, to earn respect, and to make a meaningful difference. Programs like Patriot Service Dogs show how healing these animals can be to the inmates, the veterans, and everyone around them.
It has shown me that everyone deserves a second chance, and that what a wonderful thing that their second chance leads into veterans' second chances. And for all of us, you know, we can all do better tomorrow. We can all go to bed tonight smarter. That's what I've learned.
It is amazing that an eager-to-please puppy can become a vital connection between two very different populations, helping one rehabilitate and the other recover. That is some pretty fine therapy. Speaking of helping others, Growing Boulder contributor Dr. James Smith Jr. is a global leader in personal and professional improvement who specializes in creating performance breakthroughs for individuals, teams, and organizations. He helps people worldwide reach their full potential by facing their fears and jumping into life. Here's Dr. James.
Last year, I went skydiving. It was in August. The actual date was 8/18/18. I jumped out of a plane. I did it because my greatest fear in life, heights. So I wanted to face my fear. I did it. It was successful. It was surreal. The plane landed. I'm like, I did it. I did it. I jumped out of a plane. Went home, told everybody. If you were near me and had a pulse, you heard about my jump. I talked to my mentor about it, and she smiled and said, that's nice. However, what about doing that more often? Not jumping out of a plane, but facing that fear every day, where you jump into your leadership, you jump into your life, you jump into how you love. It's not living an isolated life or an event life. It's jumping out there every day to live your life in a big way. So that's what I tell people now. Live big. Whatever it is in life, jump. Don't do an event, not isolated. Live that way every day. Jump into your bigness, regardless of where you are in your life. Go for it, and I'll see you on the other side.
Well, that is pretty much the question. I think that's what it all boils down to for each of us. Are we going to jump into life, or are we going to sit on the sidelines? It is easy to be trapped by fear. There are many older people who have been subjected to the ageist messaging for years who believe that their time is past and that they are beyond the age of possibility. And, you know, sadly, they're okay with that. They have come to find comfort in the cage that confines them. And that cage is their belief system about what's possible, their belief system about what's not possible. I think we've all seen the prison movies where the old inmates who are paroled after spending decades behind bars almost never want their freedom. They've lost the ability to make decisions for themselves, and they are now comforted by their cage. But folks, this is not living. That is simply existing while serving out a life sentence. Growing older in an ageist society is not unlike becoming the prisoner who comes to prefer his cage. Growing bolder is about removing the mental shackles and escaping that cage. It's about disconnecting from the ageist propaganda machine. It's about jumping into life and embracing the nearly limitless opportunities of age. So make it a good week. Get out there and lean into life. Be bold. And as Dr. James says, jump in. We'll see you next time.
The Growing Boulder Radio Show is a production of Growing Boulder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Boulder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. Chief audio engineer is Mac Dula. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, flowing high and mighty trapped. Countless fires.